are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's Thursday, February 7th, 2019. My name is Michael Brooks on a Michael Thursday, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Kate Aronoff, fellow at Type Media Center, contributing writer for The Intercept, as well as The Jacobin Magazine. We're talking about the for real, no BS, democratic socialist plan for a Green New Deal, and also why it's time to press criminal charges against fossil fuel executives. Trump makes a last-ditch pitch on the border wall, doubling down again, as he always will, on white nationalism. Virginia Democratic Attorney General says he also wore black face. What the F is going on with Virginia? Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax of Virginia has retained Brett Kavanaugh's law firm as allegations about a sexual assault emerge. Senator Amy Klobuchar, well, her proposals are boring, but apparently her treatment of her staff is not. She can't find, apparently, someone to manage her presidential bid because of stories about what a monster she is to work for. Another horrifying miscarriage of justice in Brazil. President Lula given another 12 years on another property he didn't own, and there was no records connecting him to for kitchen renovations. This comes about a week after an exorcism done in his office, and that was within days of not being allowed to go to his brother's funeral, as this corrupt judiciary and fascist government in Brazil, backed by the United States, tries to erase and destroy the legacy of Brazil's most important president. House Intelligence Chair announces sweeping investigation into Trump's finances in Russia. Yeah, I wonder if they will find things. Justice Department reopens, is opening a probe into Jeffrey Epstein, the financier convicted of child sexual predation, who has connections to Donald Trump, Alan Dershowitz, Prince Andrew, former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak, and of course, Donald Trump's labor secretary. Apparently, he's not part of the inner circle. Germany makes moves to restrict Facebook's data mining. May heads back to Brexit as she continues to fail to figure out how to handle Brexit. Mike Pompeo talks nonsense about Hezbollah in Venezuela as the Maduro government refuses humanitarian aid. And a whole bunch more on today's Majority Report. We should have taken a picture last night. I realize.
I feel like we say that every year.
We always say that every time we do our annual Majority Report dinner. But by the time we have to take Sam by the arms and escort him out of the restaurant, we're usually post-picture.
After the second bottle of red wine.
Yes. Yeah, so like, does anybody want more red wine? And then we're all like, yeah, I mean, if you're buying, sure. And then Brendan's like, no, I am eating fish. Pardon.
Yeah, Sam really let me have it.
There was like a New England etiquette fight going on between, like, bizarre nonsense between Brendan and Sam last night.
Yeah. Sam apparently doesn't eat freshwater fish.
Freshwater fish, no.
Brackish, I'll eat with brackish is fine.
Brackish is okay. Oysters, you never know where they came from. You just suck them right out. What, freshwater fish? Freshwater fish is the lavender of the sea. Oh my God. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was snubbed by Nancy Pelosi, who had some very just boring, dull comments about the Green New Deal today, which is, you know, or yesterday. Everybody supports it, but nobody knows what it is. Well, we're going to explain precisely not only what it is, but the contours around it with Kate Aronoff, who's one of the probably, I would say, the leading journalist of this in the game in a few minutes. And the leading politician of the Green New Deal is, of course, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She was on, did an extended interview with NPR and Steve Inskeep that came out just, I believe, either yesterday during All Things Considered or today for Morning Edition. I'm not sure. Maybe I should look at my sound sheet. Morning Edition. So it came out today. Here she is. She gets the, you know, you expect to get the you know, how are you going to pay for it question, yada, yada, yada. But this is really important, actually, because not only does she parlay this question, but this is actually a broader argument she gets into here, which I know that, you know, this is where the MMT stuff is really important for how we discuss policymaking. This is AOC talking about how to pay for a Green New Deal.
You're talking about things that obviously would cost a lot of money. Mm-hmm. I know you'd rather think of it as an investment rather than a cost, but it is just certainly a lot of money. You don't specify where it's going to come from other than saying it will all pay for itself.
Yeah, I think the first thing that we need to do is kind of break the mistaken idea that taxes pay for 100% of government expenditure. It's just not how government expenditure works. We can recoup costs, but oftentimes you look at, for example, the GOP tax cut, which I think was an irresponsible use of government expenditure. But government projects are often financed by a combination of taxes, deficit spending, and other kinds of investments, you know, bonds and so on.
Well, I get that, but deficit spending is borrowing money that has to be paid back eventually through taxes.
Yeah, and I think that is always the crux of it. So when we decide to go into the realm of deficit spending, we have to do so responsibly. We ask, is this an investment or is this actually going to pay for itself?
So you're saying borrow the money, make the investment, the economy will grow, we'll pay off the debt.
Absolutely, because we're creating jobs.
Although I do have to say, you mentioned the Republican tax cut. They said the same thing about the tax cut. Let's do this tax cut, the economy will grow, it's going to be great, it's going to pay for itself. Hasn't turned out to be true at all.
Absolutely. And I think that is an important distinction to make, because when they were advancing that cause, they had no evidence to say that these things were going to happen. But we actually do have the evidence. For every $1 invested in infrastructure, we get $6 back.
Okay, so look, she's absolutely right on the merits. There's no doubt that particularly if you have control over your own currency and spending, you can do these types of moves. And this is actually, as Zach Carter points out, this is one of the things that sort of broke the brains of the 90s consensus, because through several cycles now, there's been this, oh my God, the deficit's going to come and we're going to pay the price. There was a whole scam that threw off the economic recovery after Wall Street melted the economy in 2008, of people all of a sudden saying we need to go into austerity. In fact, the United States had a bit of a better recovery, in fact, a much better recovery than the European Union, because of even just an incredibly modest stimulus package that the Obama administration pushed through before, unfortunately, acquiescing to austerity themselves. The Eurozone sunk their whole economy through austerity and, of course, seriously practiced, you know, just vicious cruelty on Greece. So she's absolutely right on the merits. And also in terms of the more narrow question, yes, how many more jets can oligarchs buy? That has diminishing returns. If you put money into normal people's pockets and create jobs, it has it has a stimulative effect. That's the stat on put in one, get six out. Now, it's frankly a boring, annoying question that we already sort of know the answer to. But look, whatever. NPR is going to ask that question. They're going to ask how you pay for it. What is actually pretty unacceptable journalistic malpractice is to draw the equivalency between Republicans talking about their top-end tax redistribution and us and investing in energy infrastructure and generating a new economy. We know empirically those two things are not comparable. You could even, on far ends of comparison here, you could even just look at the results of the Obama 2009 stimulus as well as the Trump tax giveaway or the Bush tax giveaway. And you could see these things had very different effects in terms of bang for your buck. So the fact that that is still a talking point, I don't think you'll ever get to a point, and frankly, I don't know that you should. As much as I might roll my eyes at the question, I think, how are you going to pay for it? Okay, that question will continue. The equivalency between investing in transforming our energy infrastructure and the massive social, economic, and ecological benefits of that versus yet another tax giveaway, when even Bill Clinton was sort of explaining that trickle-down didn't work in the 90s relative to Reagan and Bush tax cuts, that's ridiculous. Like, NPR just needs to update their style guide on that.
Also, we're never going to just pay the debt.
Never.
Like,
no, nor should we. That would be really bad.
Yeah, but it's somehow implicit in a lot of these questions. Like, well, someday we're going to need to, you know, balance the books on this. Maybe not.
There's not going to be a day where the President of the United States and the Premier of China sit down and the President writes a check for $3 trillion from the Treasury and they both are just like, all right, it was nice doing business with you. We'll go back to our respective spheres of influence. That's not how it works. That's not how the economy or international relations works. And also, if you want to talk about coming to a head with debt, I'm far less concerned about government debt, but you do need to, for countries that have been systemically exploited in the global system through histories of colonialism, imperialism, or through austerity and abuse today. So this could be anywhere from Haiti to Ukraine. You need to have massive debt relief. You need to have a jubilee for the entire African continent. You need to have a jubilee for great parts of Latin America, Asia, Eastern Europe. And there also needs to be mass public debt forgiveness, as an example, in the form of student loans in the United States. Everybody's student loans in the United States should be erased. Would have huge economic benefit and, of course, be the right thing to do. So if you want to have like a come-to-a-head conversation about debt, I'm all for it. Let's talk about all the debts we need to erase and forgive so we don't have a loan shark economy anymore. Today's show is in part brought to you by the Calming Comfort Blanket. There's no need to suffer through another sleepless night thanks to the Calming Comfort by Sharper Image. The luxurious weighted blanket is made with super soft velveteen material designed with high density comfort to fill and promote a sense of calmness. Plus, by applying an even amount of pressure over your body, Calming Comfort helps the production of serotonin and melatonin and mimics the soothing feeling of being hugged for a restful night's sleep. I'll say I've actually tried this blanket and I have always had a really hard time falling asleep. I just sort of, you know, lay there, roll around, think about stuff. You know, there's so much going on. When I have started using this thing, I think it has cut my fall asleep time by half. And then I'm out like a light. It's incredibly chill, calming, and is in fact calming comfort. The Calming Comfort blanket comes with a 90-day anxiety-free, stress-free, best night's sleep of your life guarantee from Sharper Image. And right now, our listeners can go to calmingcomfortblanket.com and use promo code MAJORITY at checkout to receive $15 off of this displayed price. Again, that's calmingcomfortblanket.com, promo code MAJORITY, because you can't put a price on a great night's sleep. calmingcomfort.com, promo code MAJORITY. Thursday's Valentine's Day, folks. Get your head in the game. Actually, Sherry's berries are so They're delicious. You could have their chocolate share strawberries at any time. If you can muscle Sam out of the way. He's like, yang, yang, yang. You can never go wrong. I did last year, made some Sherry's Berries orders. It was a great idea. They were well received by all, including my mom. You can never go wrong with Sherry's Berries signature dipped Valentine's strawberries dipped in milk, dark, or white chocolate, chocolatey goodness for any discerning palate, and topped with decadent chocolate chips and heart and glitter sprinkles. Your Valentine will fall in love with every bite. They are the perfect companion to a candlelight dinner, a bouquet of flowers, or a night on the town. They ship anywhere nationally, and they always arrive fresh with 100% Sherry's Berries guarantee. It is amazing how fresh they are, because you do just kind of think in your head, like, these things are being shipped. Well, you know, they're strawberries. They're the freshest strawberries I've tasted that don't come directly off, that you don't just pick directly. They're incredibly fresh and delicious. Valentine's Day is right around the corner, so send your Valentine the gift of their dreams at the price of your dreams, starting at just $19.99 plus shipping and handling. Order now and make this Valentine's really special by adding a dozen red roses for just $19.99 more. Shipped with your Sherry's Berries at no extra charge. Just go to berries.com, click on the microphone, and enter code CEDER, S-E-D-E-R, at checkout. That's berries.com. Click the microphone, enter code CEDER, order today. Folks, we're going to take a brief break, and we'll be right back with Kate Aronoff.
Many mothers sighing. News had just come over. We had 5 years left to cry. News guy wept and told us Earth was really dying. Cried so much his face was wet. Then I knew was not lying. I heard telephones, opera house, favorite melodies. I saw boys, toys, electric irons and TVs. My brain hurt like a warehouse. It had no room to spare. I had to cram so many things to store everything in there. And all the fat, skinny people. And all the tall, short people. And all the
welcome back. Michael Brooks here on the Majority Report. Joining us now is Kate Aronoff. She is a fellow at the Type Media Center and a contributing writer at The Intercept. She's also just written and co-edited this series for the Jacobin magazine on the foundations of a Green New Deal. Kate, thanks for being here. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for doing this. So let's start with the Green New Deal's five freedoms. This is one of several pieces that you and your co-authors put out in the Jacobin magazine. What are the five freedoms of the Green New Deal?
So sort of following in the mold of FDR's four freedoms, we laid out five that are really sort of set for the 21st century and the various crises that we face. And so those are freedom from fear, freedom from toil, freedom to move, freedom from domination, and the freedom to live. So the sort of crux tying all of those things together is that, you know, the climate crisis is often talked about, this thing that we can only sort of defeat if we sacrifice so many things, if we, you know, give up hamburgers and vacations and the sort of things that make our lives so wasteful and carbon intensive. But what we think is that that actually really breaks down a lot of the power relationships that are embedded in how this crisis has come to be. And so that plays out on the international level. So the United States and what are known as historical emitters are the most responsible for this crisis. But maybe even more so than that, fossil fuel companies are extremely responsible for this. About 100 companies exactly, have been responsible for 71% of global emissions since 1988. And so those fossil fuel executives, right, will have to give up some things. Very, very wealthy individuals who take frequent plane trips between London and New York, for instance, as many bankers do, who live hugely carbon-intensive lifestyles, they'll have to sacrifice some things, right? But for the rest of us, life can actually get much better. And so what we lay out in sort of, you know, supporting the sort of vision for a Green New Deal are these freedoms in the kind of way that most people's lives can really improve as we transition to a low carbon economy. So take something like freedom from fear. So, you know, we're already locked in for a certain amount of warming. We're probably on our way to about 1.3 degrees, no matter what we do. And that means more extreme temperatures, that means stronger storms, that means some level of sea level rise. And sort of what we put out is that nobody should have to fear that they won't, you know, have a roof over their head when that happens, that it won't be, that they won't be protected from those things. And moreover, that people should never live in fear of things like food scarcity or water shortages, or moreover, from the kinds of racist colonial and sexual violence that sort of define and make so many people's lives so difficult. People shouldn't, you know, fear that if they have to leave their country, they'll face a militarized border and be interned in inhumane facilities, as we were seeing along our southern border.
Right.
I can go into each of them, but
that's great. And maybe actually I would love another couple of examples, because I love how it follows and expands on FDR. I think that's a really, really effective model for communicating this. But I think it's really important to really underline this kind of like critique of lifestyle politics that I feel like you're doing. And because for a couple of reasons, in my mind at least. One, obviously there's going to be changes, I think, you know, particularly hopefully in how we get around and move, right? Mm-hmm. Like a lot more public transportation, a lot less cars, a lot more density, and a lot more, you know, tighter communities and more efficiency and so on. But the frame that, you know, we have this like cataclysmic global crisis, and the answer is that you, individual consumer, should buy more recycled goods, eat less meat. And as always, I always have to stipulate, I'm not critiquing these things. I buy recycled goods. I'm not a vegetarian, but I certainly don't eat that much meat. And the ones I do is, you know, organic and so on. And I understand people have a million responses to those things. But my point being is I'm not leveling a critique in anybody's personal choices. I think that's great. But I do think that the frame that any of your personal choices are going to in any way really fundamentally deal with this crisis is just absurd on its face. Connected to which, the rhetoric of lifestyleism actually does correlate with evading the fundamental questions that we have to ask about inequality and capital that contribute to this crisis. And then I just want to put on the table too, it also does start to kind of manifest in sick ways. Like if it's all just about your kind of individual output, well, an oligarch, I think this is basically a scam, but you know, sure, I took a private jet, but I bought carbon offsets to plant trees in Swaziland. Mm-hmm. So I'm fine. Now you, on the other hand, you know, poor person in the Bronx or Mumbai, you should use less air conditioning during the heat wave because we have a climate crisis. And that actual synthesis of the covering up of the inequality and capital dynamics behind the climate crisis, with an emphasis on lifestyleism, starts to get really clear, I think, in those contrasting examples of the kind of social and economic pathologies that they put forward.
Yeah, I think you said it exactly right. And I don't think we can understand how this rhetoric plays out in the climate world without sort of understanding the last 30 to 40 years of history in which neoliberalism has really done a good job at convincing people that, you know, as Margaret Thatcher said, there's no such thing as society. And so, you know, in this focus on individual responsibility for everything, you know, we hear similar rhetoric around poverty. It's like, if you are in poverty, it's because you didn't work hard enough, right? And it's that kind of logic extended in, you know, maybe more subtle ways to the climate. And it's just as absurd, right? Just like, you know, people often can't get a job because the economy doesn't want to give them a job. Often people consume because the economy structures the way that they consume, right? And so I don't think it's really useful to shame people for eating meat or for, you know, even going on vacation or something and taking a plane that they find a ticket for that's really cheap and they've never, you know, traveled out of the country or something. Like, I don't think it's really useful to shame people for that, especially, you know, when we haven't created really robust alternatives. And again, I think the key point, as you said, and I said earlier, is that this really just covers up so many power relationships and the really sort of absurd way in which responsibility for this crisis is concentrated in such a small number of very, very wealthy people and industries.
Yeah, and I would just also, I think I would add, we'll get back to maybe a couple of other examples of these freedoms, which you outlined so well, but I would also add, you know, having children to that list, right? Because you look at the history, both, I mean, going back particularly to like the 70s and how ideas from like the population bomb and stuff were applied to trying to shrink population growth in Africa and Asia. And he's just like, I mean, the rhetoric was horrifying. And the context enormously disturbing on these highly exploited continents to say, well, yeah, but the real answer is you should have less kids. But even down to today, that every kind of, you know, lifestyle politics article about like, well, I'm lessening my carbon footprint by not having a kid is actually just sweeping under the rug. And I know, you know, there's been pieces published by about this in the Jacobin recently, just like actually the fact that there's a horrific hole in the safety net for young families, for regardless of whatever reasons people are having kids. And it's another, it's a way in which this stuff is actually getting marshaled to justify bad punitive policies in general and actually undermine the basic decency and well-being that everybody should have.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think I can say it any better than that, but I would just add that, you know, this is a really sort of convenient line for processing companies. It's a really convenient line for the people who actually hold responsibility for this crisis to sort of cast that off and talk about these sort of, you know, sustainability measures or whatever, you know, whether that be banning plastic straws or you know, up until having kids and talking about population and stuff. And I think, you know, that just really sort of, whether it's fossil fuel executives who are saying it or not, it really just does play into covering up their role in having known about this crisis for decades now, and not just sort of gone in the other direction and continued to do something they know is so bad for the planet and for the people on it, but actively funding disinformation campaigns to, you know, obscure the reality of that. Of that crisis and the findings of their own scientists.
What about freedom from toil?
Yeah, so this is one of my favorite ones that we included. I think something that doesn't get talked about enough when we talk about the Green New Deal is that people could probably work less. And so we have this idea, right, when we talk about green jobs, of people putting up wind turbines, of putting up solar panels on homes, you know, that's certainly all part of it. But I don't want to focus overly on how much, there is a lot of work to do, obviously, to create this transition. But if we set it up right, people can also work much shorter work weeks. And so, you know, why is that? If you think about a lot of the work that people do in the country, it's not, it's not necessarily productive in any sort of like societally meaningful way. It's productive for corporate profits. But, you know, there's no reason why if you are taking a job with under a federal job guarantee, for instance, and you're doing something like remediating wetlands, for instance, or you're hanging out with old folks, which is another thing that, that a federal job guarantee could do, or writing plays, you know.
Yeah.
That's both, you know, hopefully labor that's less alienated. So it's things that are, you know, improving your community that you can find value in. It's not just sort of producing widgets for so that a few corporate executives can profit. So I think that, you know, is one way in which solving the climate crisis or mitigating the climate crisis helps to take away toil. But it's also that, you know, people can like have vacations and things. Like if you're working 20 hours a week, because we've decided as a society that we don't need to produce mountains of cheap junk and sell that cheap junk to people, then there's more time to, you know, go to the beach, to take high-speed rail, which we will hopefully build as part of the Green New Deal, to go hang out with your friends in other cities. There's all this sort of like realm of life that I think gets so sort of tragically lost under capitalism because people, you know, are working too many jobs. The unemployment rate is low in the United States. But how much of that is people working, you know, awful jobs, two or three jobs at a time? And so I think this is, you know, a real sort of quality of life question, and that people can have a better quality of life. And there's no reason why in the United States, where we work so much more than so many other parts of the world, people can't sort of, you know, have their 8 hours for what they will, as the old labor saying goes, or hopefully much more.
Definitely. It reminds me of a book, Wasted Lives by Zygmunt Bauman, where he drew the connection between, it's obviously you're in a more privileged position mostly, just as a kind of generic statement, if you have a job than if you don't. Obviously, there's different types of exceptions, right? If you're sitting on a bunch of income and not working. But overall, if you have a job, but he did draw this correlation just of the theme of wasted life. So whether you're totally grinded out and just, you know, literally physically or emotionally destroyed by work, that's a way of sort of being grinded and wasted and discarded. And then there's also the overt waste and discard of, you know, you are structurally useless in this system, which is the sort of like structurally unemployed, right? And then also implicitly saying, right, because there's plenty of people who are, you know, quote unquote unemployable, but they might actually have a lot of the assets and traits that you outlined in terms of like being great mentors or good people to hang out in different community contexts or contribute art or contribute, you know, all sorts of other forms of labor. So it also like, I love it because it's like you both decrease all of the trash work that we use to just create surplus for companies, but we also sort of open up a much bigger set of human capacities that we can harness.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And it's such a sort of narrow realm of what we consider to be productive,
right?
In capitalism. And I think, you know, as happened during the original New Deal, you know, you can pay people to like put on great plays, for instance, and you know, go around the country writing travel guides for different states. Like that was a Works Progress Administration program. And it's awesome. Like those travel guides still exist and they're really fun to read. You know, I think that's totally within the realm of the
great murals. I mean, sometimes you will just randomly see some like great building in upstate New York. And like, what, when did that happen? And it's like, oh, right. That was a New Deal thing. They paid people to do, you know, just to create something that looked great and usually could serve some really excellent community purpose. The Nancy Pelosi said, I think yesterday, like, oh, everybody likes the New Deal, Green New Deal, but nobody knows what it is. And right. So, okay. I think we kind of do. But that being said, I mean, you point out that the Green New Deal rhetoric has been around for a long time. And maybe there's a socialist version of it. Maybe there's a kind of progressive-y version of it. Maybe there's a straight-up Bloombergian third-way version of it. AOC's unveiled her version today, but just broadly, so this term doesn't get lost, what are we looking for in terms of the details for a plan that really does carry out those five freedoms?
Yeah, so this five-page resolution that Representative Ocasio-Cortez introduced along with Senator Ed Markey, there's a lot in it. I'll go through the sort of policy highlights and then get into the politics of it. So the main goal is to get to 100% of the demand for power in the United States with clean, renewable, and zero emission energy sources, which is a goal that's in line with the scientific consensus on climate change, unlike a lot of other climate policy. This would provide all people in the United States with clean air and water, with healthy and affordable food, high quality healthcare, affordable, safe, and adequate housing, and economic security. It would do things like create a federal job guarantee, as we were just talking about, massive infrastructure build out, building efficiency upgrades, robust investment in public transit. It would ensure that in building up low carbon infrastructure, we're not infringing on indigenous people's land rights or abusing the power of eminent domain. It would provide a just transition and ensure a dignified quality of life for workers and communities that have historically relied on coal, oil, and natural gas jobs. I could go on. It's a five-page resolution, so I won't list out everything. But really, sort of what this does is to set a standard for a Green New Deal and say, look, this isn't just a talking point. We're talking about very concrete things that we'd like to do. This isn't, the sort of most this isn't the legislation that will be passed that implements the Green New Deal, right? They, Ocasio-Cortez had asked for a select committee on a Green New Deal, which Nancy Pelosi decided not to create, which would have spent a year looking at these sorts of proposals and coming up with that sort of detailed plan. And so that's something that folks are very interested in doing outside of Congress and hopefully as much as possible sort of within Washington. This sort of says to especially, potential 2020 contenders who have said they all support a Green New Deal, this is what you're talking about. You can't just talk about a couple of renewable energy tax credits for a select group of entrepreneurs as a Green New Deal. You really have to be committed to this really wildly ambitious goal of getting to 100% renewable, clean, and zero emission power by 2030.
The public sector, and it's about democracy. It's not about offloading it in these sort of public-private partnerships to incentivize this or that. It's mobilizing our resources as a collective to achieve massive goals.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not opposed per se to private investment. It's not saying there can't be private capital as part of it.
Right.
But what it does assert, even sort of in the preamble, is say that the United States has done big things before. As they say, the federal government led mobilizations during World War II and the New Deal that created the greatest middle class the United States has ever seen. We've done this before. We can do this. And this is kind of what we want to be the principles of carrying that out.
We have a couple minutes left. And I think, the corollary of this is another piece in Jacobin that you published. It's time to try fossil fuel executives for crimes against humanity. Make the case.
So I mentioned a bit of this earlier, but fossil fuel companies have known for a very, very long time, since as early as the late 50s, they have been doing research into the existence of climate change. And what they found not too long after they started doing that research was not only is this a massive problem, but a massive problem that will create untold suffering for so many people, that our product is causing it. Our product has a massive role to play in this. Shell in the 80s found that they were responsible for 4% of greenhouse gas emissions. That's a figure that they identified. And so even with this knowledge, they were very, very active in pouring so much money into disinformation campaigns that we all know so well, that, you know, allow for think tanks to send out sort of climate denying fact sheets to freshmen, everyone from sort of freshman state senators to senators in the Congress, and just blanketly deny the existence of climate change. And so all the while that they were doing that, they were continuing to dig up more fossil fuels, to explore for new reserves, and to lobby Congress against passing any sort of even common sense regulations on them, to tear up regulations where they did exist, and basically to give them a free rein and to give them, you know, the $20 billion a year they collect annually in subsidies in various forms. And so the industry has a clear knowledge that they have been causing this problem. They know, even beyond Exxon and Shell, who we have, you know, documentation proving that they knew this for a while, no one can deny the mass suffering that climate change will cause. No one can deny that the fossil fuel industry is causing it. And yet they continue to do that. And so under the Rome Statute, which sort of lays out what constitutes a crime against humanity, my case is that qualifies.
I agree with your case.
Well, thank you.
How are you going to pay for it, Kate? No, I'm just kidding. That's the real question is how are you going to pay for it? A lot of people are talking about the Rome Statute, but that requires additional court space at The Hague. So I'm Steve Inskeep. How do you pay for that? Kate Aronoff, I really appreciate your time. Check out all of the pieces on The Jacobin and follow all of Kate's work. Of course, we'll have links to her Twitter and all the other ways you can follow her. She's a fellow at the Type Media Center and a contributing writer at The Intercept. Kate, thanks a million for doing this.
Thanks for having me.
All right, folks, we are going to go to the fun half right quick. Become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become. A member. That's how this show happens. JustCoffee.coop. You can check out our sponsorship page. There'll be links, in fact, to all of the sponsors of today's show that you can check out. And sorry? I got only two. Hold on.
Just before we get to that. Nancy Pelosi in this, this is the actual quote about the Green New Deal. She said, it will be one of several or maybe many suggestions that we receive. The Green Dream, or whatever they call it, nobody knows what it is, but they're for it, right? The Green Dream. And Natalie Shore points out
trash, man.
That underrated loathsome aspect of this is her intentional botching of the name.
Right.
She, this is Natalie speaking, so I'm not going to censor her. She fucking knows what it's called and is being willfully disparaging. Green New Deal explicitly evokes one of the most popular moments in presidential history.
Right.
Green Dream evokes childish nonsense.
That's so, precisely it.
Like as a Marco Rubio once said, she knows exactly what she's doing.
She knows exactly what she's doing. And it's really, you know, and it is, it's absolutely shameful. And, you know, I think especially us, like, we've played and will continue to play it very fair with Nancy Pelosi. You know, she's dominated Trump very well. A lot of the ire at the Democratic leadership in a narrow sense should be much more focused at Schumer than Pelosi. But the bottom line is, and this is really where it just comes down to like the stuff you got to be, that should be just talked about a lot more. It's just politics. And her politics are different radically than our politics. And part of that is because of the money and the contributions that she gets. That is, you know, I think, actually some of the ways people talk about money in politics gets very simplistic. There's much bigger questions of really just existing in a marketplace. Some of it's maybe generational. Some of it's maybe temperamental. I don't know. I don't care. But there's been the substantive snubs, like not doing the subcommittee. And then there's the childish undermining of it, which you saw there. And, you know, this is still in a context of people actually whispering that the most, you know, any adjective you could throw, successful, dynamic, interesting, high profile, important, influential young politician in the country should be primaried. I mean, of course, it's not a direct comparison because President Obama was a centrist, but just on a pure media level, could you imagine if Barack Obama got into the Senate in 2004 and just, and you know, he was, it was a very different thing. He was, again, he was in the center of the party and he was de-emphasizing his media profile. But just how demented, just, could you imagine just like, oh, we should primary that guy. Totally. Yeah. He's the most talented politician in the country. We should primary him. Of course, it's different with Ocasio-Cortez because of ideology and because she represents a different politics than the Democratic leadership. Some of it's also petty as fuck jealousy. And, you know, the idea that people are looking, and it would have to be, even if they got some decent local politician, although you really couldn't be decent, you'd have to be an absolute idiot to challenge her. You would have to front load that campaign with real estate and Wall Street money and just run on smears. And the fact that that's actually like a conversation in D.C., I don't want to exaggerate it, but you've heard enough of these ripples to know that it is actually a thing, not just something that one random idiot said and all the other sane people dismissed, shows how deep and insane the problem is, as does Pelosi's just loathsome comments about the Green New Deal. Of course, the Michael Brooks Show, you can become a patron at patreon.com/DMBS. Tune in, 7 o'clock Thursday show tonight. We're back to Tuesday next week with Mark Blythe as the guest. Tonight, our guests are Jeffrey Halper from Israelis Against Home Demolition, and then Breonna Joy Gray. We're talking about State of the Union, Abraham Sanders, but we're looking very specifically and pretty broadly at the Kamala Harris record, what's that is all about. Michael Brooks Show YouTube channel at 7 tonight. Get the whole thing, patreon.com/TMBS. Matt, Literary Hangover.
Yep, check it out, Literary Hangover.
Check out also Jamie's show, The Antifada. Okay. We'll leave you with this. Calming Comfort by Sharper Image is the luxurious weighted blanket that's designed with high-density comfort to Calming Comfort by Sharper Image is the luxurious weighted blanket that's designed with high-density comfort fill to promote a sense of calmness for a restful night's sleep. The Calming Comfort blanket comes with a 90-day anxiety-free best night's sleep of your life guarantee from Sharper Image. And now our listeners can go to calmingcomfortblanket.com and use promo code MAJORITY at checkout to receive $15 off of the display price. That's $15 off the displayed price. Again, that's calmingcomfortblanket.com. Use promo code MAJORITY because you can't put a price on a great night's sleep. We'll see you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.